Saving money on your entire roofing project now at Menards. Protect your home for years to come with Owens Corning Architectural Shingles. They offer long-lasting performance while providing ultimate protection with a 130 miles per hour wind rating and limited lifetime warranty. Choose from over 50 options of Owens Corning shingles in-store and on Menards.com. And check out more of our great deals going on now. Save big money at Menards.
Disease has a way of making people paranoid. I mean, how could it not? Even in our own times, with all of our knowledge about the nature of disease transmission, there is still something darkly mysterious about contagion. The idea that just being near an infected person can mean that you are now infected is objectively terrifying, especially when the disease is something that could prove fatal. When I started writing this series on the Black Death, I wasn't trying to be topical. To me, the 14th century plague was simply an interesting historical moment that birthed a number of fascinating historical myths. But then, not long after I released that first episode, coronavirus started to dominate international news. As of this recording, coronavirus is still big news internationally. And while it's certainly not the Black Death, the public reaction has been, well, let's call it historically consistent. A reasonable fear of disease very quickly has a way of transforming into panicky paranoia. What's worse, this paranoia has a way of triggering old prejudices. Coronavirus certainly is something that needs to be taken seriously. It's currently a disease with a body count. But perhaps we can learn a little something from history and not let our fears push us towards counterproductive and sometimes tragic bouts of anxiety. If we look back to the Black Death of the 14th century, we see a European population eager to find someone to blame for the horrors of the plague. Predictably, blame fell on the people who always seemed to bear the brunt of irrational fear: foreigners, the poor, and Jews. As the plague spread through Europe, these groups very quickly became targets of violence. In Sicily, one of the first places in Europe to experience an outbreak of the plague, the minority population of Catalans were violently targeted as being responsible for the disease. For those of you who don't know, Catalans are originally from the region around Barcelona in what is today Spain. What's particularly weird about this outburst of violence is that all the Sicilian chronicles seem especially confident that the disease was brought to the region by Genoese sailors. In fact, there is a very famous passage about 12 infamous death ships that passed through Sicily on their way home to Genoa from the Black Sea. So, the Sicilians, more than any other group of people, should have known where the plague was coming from. And yet, they still turned on the ethnic minority living amongst them. In this case, Catalans. This first example really underscores how illogical these persecutions were. Throughout Europe, you also get reports of beggars being rounded up and burnt en masse as a means of eradicating plague. Rumors began to spread that poor beggars, for no reason other than being morally depraved, had started poisoning water supplies with evil potions that caused the disease. Sometimes these prejudices would get mashed up with the medieval scientific explanation for plague that involved the movements of the planets. Historian Samuel Cohn has pointed out that in 1348, a vicomte in Narbonne concluded that, quote, "It is certainly the combined effects of the planets and the potions that is causing the mortality," end quote. This official apparently came to this conclusion after the torture and murder of hundreds of his region's poor yielded, let's call it, inconclusive testimony. Torture has a way of doing that. You can almost hear this guy's thought process. Ooh, those torture confessions weren't super reliable. Let's just say it was magic potions and the movement of the planets, just to cover our bases. But by far, the group who suffered the most as the result of Black Plague paranoia were Europe's Jewish communities. As many of you know, there is a long and violent history of anti-Semitism in both Europe and around the world, and the Black Death provides yet another disturbing chapter. Those of you who heard my series on the First Crusade might remember that some 200 years before this era, the Jewish communities of Europe became the first victims of Crusader violence. Christian Europeans whipped into a crusading fervor first turned on the non-Christians living amongst them before starting the journey to the Holy Land. Sadly, violence against the Jews during the Black Death would follow a similar pattern. Distrust bred by centuries of exclusion, prejudice, and slander fed vicious rumors about Jewish communities at the time of the Black Death. And once again, those rumors had to do with magical potions. It was believed that Jews were purposefully trying to destroy the Christian population of Europe by poisoning water supplies. The story went that the Jewish poisoners were being directed by a shadowy cabal of powerful rabbis. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, even the Black Plague was blamed on a completely fictional international Jewish conspiracy. It turns out that nasty bit of anti-Semitic slander has some very deep historical roots. Now, to be fair, many Christian Europeans did not believe this conspiracy theory. The Pope himself, Clement VI, even issued a papal bull defending Jewish communities from these accusations in 1348. The chronicles from the southern French city of Marseille actually go out of their way to note that the plague could not have been spread by Jewish people. This was because in Marseille, Jews were dying at the exact same rates as everyone else in the city. Ironically, the high mortality rates suffered by Jews in Marseille due to plague led to the city becoming a bit of a haven for Jewish people fleeing hateful violence in other parts of Europe. You see, in other parts of the continent, particularly in German-speaking cities, Jews may have had lower rates of infection than their Christian neighbors. It's been theorized that since, in some places, Jewish people were forced into ghettos that were sometimes walled off from the rest of the city, they may have had less contact with plague-infected people and plague-infected rats and fleas. It's also been suggested that Jewish Passover traditions that include rigorously cleaning your house and removing all bread products other than matzah could have also helped. When you and your neighbors are getting every crumb out of your homes, that means fewer rats, which means fewer fleas, which means less bubonic plague. Sadly, this may have just stoked suspicion and prejudice. Things escalated after officials from a region in what is today Switzerland wrote a letter to the people of Strasbourg, telling them they had conclusive proof that Jews were in fact spreading the plague by poisoning wells. A Jewish man who is identified in the sources as Balavini was, quote, put to the question by the local authorities, along with other members of his community. For those of you who don't know, put to the question is medieval speak for being tortured into giving a confession. This man was physically assaulted in unspeakable ways until he told his torturers what they wanted to hear. Eventually, he admitted that he had been given an egg-sized potion by a rabbi and had slipped it into a local well. He also admitted to distributing these little poison bundles to other Jewish members of his community. When Strausberg got this news, the authorities immediately turned on their Jewish population, even though the town had not yet been hit by plague. In fact, it was quite often cities that had not yet experienced the plague that unleashed some of the worst violence against local Jews. In Strasbourg, 2,000 Jews were rounded up and burnt on Valentine's Day, 1349. In Mainz, it's estimated 6,000 Jews were killed. Burnings took the lives of 3,000 in Erfurt. It's estimated that killings motivated by the completely wrong-headed idea that Jews were spreading the plague destroyed hundreds of Jewish communities in towns and villages across Europe, particularly in the German-speaking Rhineland region. Today, these killings seem especially hysterical and tragic because we know that poisons and potions did not cause the plague. The infamous confession provided by Balavini actually claimed that the poison he used had been extracted from a mythical monster known as a basilisk. That seems darkly appropriate, considering that the tales of a Jewish conspiracy to spread plague had much in common with basilisk stories. They were both tall tales meant to play on the irrational fears of medieval Christians. The basilisk, like the conspiracy, was not real. But while it's clear that basilisk potions did not cause the disease, there continues to be much debate around what actually did. While the scientific consensus continues to be that the bacteria Yersinia pestis was the main culprit, that explanation hasn't quite satisfied every expert on the 14th century plague. What other explanations are there for this unprecedented pandemic? Let's find out today on Our Fake History. Episode number 104, What Caused the Black Death, Part 3. Hello and welcome to Our Fake History. My name is Sebastian Major, and this is the podcast that explores historical myths and tries to determine what's fact, what's fiction, and what is such a good story that it simply must be told. This week, we are finishing out our trilogy of episodes on the devastating 14th century plague, commonly known as the Black Death. As you've hopefully already realized, this is part 3 of 3. So if you haven't heard parts 1 and 2, you may want to go back and give those a listen now. In part one, I did my best to introduce this massively consequential historical event, and I took on the belief that an early form of biological warfare used at the Siege of Kaffa could be blamed for spreading the plague from Asia to Europe. In part two, I looked at the cultural, religious, and scientific responses to the plague from the medieval era. I tried to empathize with the Parisian physicians who very wrongly concluded that the plague was caused by foul-smelling miasmas, or bad air, created by an alignment of the planets Jupiter and Mars. I also took some time to marvel at the way people dealt with what looked like the end of the world. Some indulged in bouts of drunken hedonism, others tried to hide, and others threw themselves into new and intense forms of religious devotion that involved publicly whipping themselves. And Once again, that group who whipped themselves were called the flagellants, and not the flatulence, as some on Twitter were suggesting. Although, I do kind of wish there was a fringe medieval religious movement that involved farting as a form of penitence. One can only dream. Anyway, today I want to return to the modern debates about what caused the plague and killed half of the European population in the 14th century. As I've been teasing for this entire series, the most commonly accepted explanation for the pandemic is not necessarily universally accepted. The hypothesis that the Black Death can be explained by the bacteria Yersinia pestis is solid, but for some, it does not satisfactorily explain every aspect of the 14th century epidemic. So we need to unpack all the alternate explanations to really do this topic justice. In the 1340s, Europe had recently gone through a number of important demographic shifts that made the continent particularly vulnerable to a pandemic. Much of this can be traced to trends in climate. Research into the climate of the medieval world has shown that starting around the year 1000 AD, Europe experienced a period of warming. This has been called the medieval climatic optimum, or the medieval climatic anomaly. Now, there's a bunch of debate among paleoclimatologists about whether or not this phenomena occurred globally or just affected Europe. But it does seem clear that Europe, or at least Western Europe, benefited from nearly two centuries of statistically warmer weather during what we think of as the high medieval period. And by the way, paleoclimatologist, a scientist who studies the climate of the past, is everyone's word of the day. Impress your friends with that one. This period of warming helps to explain a population boom in Europe during this era in history. Longer growing seasons and milder winters meant food surpluses, which meant a growth in population. In fact, in the two centuries leading up to the outbreak of the Great Mortality, the continent's population had doubled. By the 1300s, Europe was experiencing a bit of a land crunch. Labor was abundantly available, and therefore, it was cheap. In some cases, there were more people to work the land than there was land to work. It's in these centuries that we see European urban centers start to grow to sizes that had not been seen since the height of the Roman Empire. Places like Florence, Venice, Granada, Milan, and Paris would boast populations of around 100,000 people, and in some cases more. When the plague arrived in Europe in 1347, there were more people living there than had lived there in centuries. There were also bigger, more crowded cities and large towns than had existed for centuries. Now, don't get me wrong. At this point in history, Europe was still a predominantly agrarian society. But as evidenced by the land crunch, even in rural areas, you had new levels of population density. Densely packed populations with famously poor sanitation systems are going to be hotbeds of disease. And yet, the speed at which the Black Death moved through Europe still boggles the mind. It ripped through populations with a tenacity that some think would have been impossible for a disease spread by rat fleas. So let's look at some of the criticisms of the most commonly accepted hypothesis on the cause of the Black Death. And then let's look at some of the alternate explanations for Europe's great mortality. Let's check it out. Thank you. Back in the first episode of this series, I took you through the most commonly accepted explanation for the 14th century plague. That is, that the disease was caused by a nasty bacteria known as Yersinia pestis. This bacteria originally occurs in the black rat population, or as they're known in Latin, Rattus rattus. It's been shown that Yersinia pestis spreads to humans after an infected rat dies, and the fleas that have been feeding on it go searching for new hosts. Those hungry fleas make the leap to humans and bite them. It's these flea bites that transmit the bacteria from rats to people. Once in humans, the disease can take three forms. There's the bubonic form, which attacks the lymphatic system and creates a grotesque swelling of the lymph nodes. These swellings are often known as buboes, and they appear at the neck, armpits, or groin. Then there's the pneumonic form that attacks the respiratory system. This leads to bloody coughs and is the one form of the disease that can be spread from one human to another. Then there's the septicemic form of the disease, which infects your blood and can kill you within hours of infection. All of this was discovered back in the late 19th century, when physicians and scientists were studying an outbreak of plague that was occurring in China at the time. As you might remember, one of the doctors who made a particularly large contribution to the effort was the Swiss bacteriologist Alexandre Yersin, who lent his name to the bacteria Yersinia pestis. Now, to be clear, no one really contests the findings that Yersin and his team made back in the 1890s. They proved, and many investigations have since confirmed, that a very specific bacterial infection causes the disease that I just described. Yersinia pestis was most certainly the cause of the pandemic that spread through China in the late 19th century. The debate isn't around whether or not Yersinia pestis causes what we think of as the bubonic plague. It does. No, the debate is around whether or not the Black Death even was the bubonic plague. Was this bacteria really the cause of earlier pandemics in history? Can it explain Justinian's plague that hit the Byzantine Empire in the 6th century? And most importantly for us, does it explain the Black Death? Well, after Yersin and company's findings in the 1890s, many were quick to assume that the Black Death had in fact been the bubonic plague caused by Yersinia pestis. This was mostly due to the fact that medieval descriptions of the disease seemed to fit with what was being witnessed during the modern plague. Most importantly, the medieval sources, time and time again, made reference to the distinctive buboes appearing at the groin, neck, or armpits. For many, that sealed it. If people had buboes, then they must have had the bubonic plague. But here's the thing. Bubonic plague is not the only disease that can cause extreme swelling of the lymph nodes. There are other options. On top of that, the medieval sources offer all sorts of sometimes contradictory descriptions of the disease, and some of these descriptions sound absolutely nothing like the bubonic plague. In fact, the Yersinia pestis hypothesis has a number of weaknesses that have been pointed out over the years by experts. One academic who is most associated with the criticism of the Yersinia pestis theory is Samuel Cohn, a professor of medieval history at the University of Glasgow. Over the course of a number of books and articles, Cohn has outlined a number of big problems with the prevailing theory. The biggest issue has to be with the incredibly fast speed at which the plague spread through Europe in the mid-14th century. The first reports of the disease in Europe appear in 1347 in the Italian ports of Messina, Genoa, and Venice, along with a few other sites along the Dalmatian coast in what is today Croatia. By 1350, the disease had reached the Arctic Circle in places like Norway. It's been estimated that the Black Death moved at a rate of roughly 4 kilometers a day. That is staggering, especially when you compare it to the speed that the modern plague spread. The modern plague moved at a speed of roughly 15 to 18 kilometers a year. And that was during the late 1800s when its transmission was helped along by steamships and trains. So the medieval disease was moving at warp speed by comparison, which might suggest that it wasn't Yersinia pestis at all. The way in which Yersinia pestis is transmitted also makes the extreme speed at which the disease spread hard to explain. As I already mentioned, the bubonic plague only really spreads to people after it is burnt through a local rodent population, and hungry infected fleas start looking for new human hosts. So that means that for the disease to spread, it needs to first move from rodent to rodent. For the plague to move to a new location, rats would have to bring it there. Cohn and others have argued that rats would simply not have moved fast enough, even if they were hitching rides on ships and carts. The disease can be spread from person to person in its pneumonic form, but Cohn has pointed out that that form of plague is actually far more rare than the bubonic form. He points out that during modern outbreaks of the plague, like in Manchuria in 1911, the pneumonic form of the disease killed less than 0.3% of the infected population. In other words, not a lot of people get the pneumonic form, and therefore, not a lot of people are spreading the disease. Cohn has also noted that the modern plague can only be sustained at temperatures between 10 and 26 degrees Celsius and requires high humidity. The Black Death, on the other hand, occurred even in Norway in the middle of the winter and in the Mediterranean in the middle of hot, dry summers. So, that disease, whatever it was, seemed considerably hardier than the modern plague. Then, of course, there's the massive difference in mortality rates between the 14th century Black Death and the modern plague studied by Yersin. As I've come back to many times, the 14th century plague wiped out roughly half of Europe. It's been estimated that cities like Florence lost approximately 75% of their population. In contrast, the highest mortality for the modern bubonic plague was 3% in Bombay in 1903. It's also been pointed out that many of the primary sources from the great mortality of the 14th century describe a level of contagion that seems inconsistent with the modern bubonic plague. Take, for instance, one source that describes the arrival of plague in the city of Messina. In that source, the author details the arrival of the 12 Genoese death ships that I spoke about in the introduction. These ships apparently all carried the plague. According to the author of that source, quote, "The sailors brought in their bones a disease so violent that whoever spoke a word to them was infected and could in no way save himself from death." End quote. This sentiment is echoed by other sources we have looked at in this series, including De Musi and Boccaccio. It was widely understood in the medieval era that having any contact with an infected person, or even handling their clothes or belongings could get you sick. But what's tricky is that medieval sources are filled with exaggeration. So these descriptions might not be trustworthy. For instance, many don't believe that Sicilian writer when he says that there were 12 death ships off the coast of Messina, because 12 was a number with deep mythological and numerological importance in medieval Europe. He probably exaggerated to allow for some potent symbolism. So, if he's exaggerating about that, can we really trust him when he tells us that people caught plague by just talking to sailors? I don't have an answer here, but it's something to consider. Nevertheless, the Black Death does seem to have spread from person to person more easily than modern plague. This is perhaps best evidenced by the fact that religious orders were amongst the worst hit by the disease. Priests and monks who ministered to those dying from the plague often contracted the disease themselves. Entire monasteries were wiped out. Throughout Europe, church officials were dying faster than they could be replaced. This could perhaps be explained by the pneumonic form of the disease. But as I pointed out earlier, Samuel Cohn has shown us that in instances of the modern plague, the pneumonic form of the disease is rare and accounts for less than 1% of the deaths. So when you take all of this together, there are some serious reasons to doubt the conclusion that the Black Death was the same disease as the modern bubonic plague caused by Yersinia pestis. The speed at which the medieval disease traveled and the extreme level of contagiousness described by some of the sources seems inconsistent with the outbreaks that we know were caused by Yersinia pestis. So, if Yersinia pestis isn't the culprit, then what is? Well, let's look at some theories. Anytime you reach into a box marked alternate theories, you're always bound to pull out something interesting. However, the alternate theories about the Black Death aren't all completely fringe. As I already explained, the critiques of the Yersinia pestis hypothesis are actually quite reasonable, and they come from legitimate sources like Professor Samuel Cohn. Similarly, there are many alternate explanations that are equally reasonable. But there are also some pretty weird ones. So let's start with the weirdest and then work our way back to the most reasonable. All right. The wildest theory on what caused the Black Death that I've come across has to be one proposed by astrophysicists Fred Hoyle and Chandra Wickramasinghe in their 1979 book, Diseases from Space. As the title of the book suggests, the authors propose that the bacteria that caused the Black Death was not originally from planet Earth. Instead, they suggest that bubonic plague and a handful of other well-known diseases actually come from outer space. They connect this hypothesis to a larger theory known as panspermia, which proposes that life, especially in the form of bacteria and microorganisms, exist throughout the universe and not exclusively on Earth. Furthermore, Life on Earth got its start when biological material from space arrived on the planet carried by comets, asteroids, meteors, and other objects traveling through space. Hoyle and Wickramasinghe also point out the problem with the extremely fast spread of plague during the medieval era, and the strange fact that the plague seems to appear suddenly at certain points in history and then disappear, only to appear again centuries later. They have proposed that these mysteries can be solved if we allow for the idea that the plague bacteria came from space. They hypothesize that a heretofore unnoticed comet may be passing Earth in a semi-regular rhythm, like the famous Halley's Comet. Except this comet litters debris down on the planet containing deadly plague bacteria. This theory would explain how the disease spread so quickly. It wasn't just one rat population in Asia that started the disease. Rat populations around the world may have come in contact with a bacteria that literally fell from the sky. The cycle of outbreaks, sometimes separated by centuries, could also therefore be explained by the orbit of this mysterious plague comet. The plague only shows up when the comet is nearby, or at least so says our two astrophysicists. This is a fun theory, but it has been largely rejected by the scientific community. Panspermia appears to be a viable hypothesis in general, but there's just no hard evidence that the plague specifically originates off-world. Hoyle and Wickramasinghe's mystery plague comet has never been properly identified. As of right now, there's simply far too little empirical proof to sustain this claim. So, I think it can be safely discarded. A slightly more viable alternate theory on the true causes of the plague comes from the British zoologist Graham Twigg. In 1984, Twigg published a book called The Black Death, A Biological Reappraisal. This book was effectively the first proper scientific re-examination of the causes of the Black Death since Yersin's work back in 1894. Diseases from space notwithstanding. In Black Death, A Biological Reappraisal, Twigg first laid out many of the scientific problems with the Yersinia pestis theory, which would later be picked up and elaborated on by the likes of Samuel Cohn. Instead of Yersinia pestis, Twigg proposes that the Black Death may have actually been caused by a different bacteria. Anthrax. Yes, anthrax. The same anthrax that had people afraid to open their mail back in the early 2000s. For those who don't know, anthrax is actually a naturally occurring bacteria that can be found on every continent, even Antarctica. Anthrax is spread when people have contact with diseased animal products or ingest bad meat. So perhaps Europe had an outbreak of anthrax amongst its livestock population, which got into people when they ate the infected meat. Twigg and others who support the anthrax theory point to historical evidence that bad meat infected with what was known as a cattle murrain was being sold in England directly prior to the outbreak of the plague. So who knows? Maybe that meat gave those people the disease. This theory is bolstered by the fact that exposure to anthrax can create symptoms that look a whole lot like what was being described during the Black Death. Cutaneous anthrax infection in humans shows up as a boil-like skin lesion that eventually forms an ulcer with a black center. This sounds like how some medieval sources described buboes, which it's worth pointing out, were not always reported as recording near the lymph nodes. In some sources, it was said that these boils occurred all over the body. That's far more consistent with anthrax than it is with Yersinia pestis. Respiratory infection caused by anthrax initially presents with cold or flu-like symptoms for several days before creating a complete respiratory collapse. Again, this sounds very similar to the pneumonic form of plague. Finally, gastrointestinal infection in humans, which is caused by eating anthrax-infected meat, is characterized by serious gastrointestinal difficulty and the vomiting of blood, which is also a symptom described in medieval sources. On top of all that, anthrax exposure has a mortality rate that is consistent with the plague. The respiratory form of the disease historically has a 92% chance of death. Historians like Norman Cantor have also pointed out that anthrax spores have been found at a plague pit or a mass grave for plague victims near Glasgow, Scotland. So, maybe the plague was anthrax. The only problem with the anthrax hypothesis has to do with the spread of the disease. Through the sources, we can very clearly trace the disease from the Black Sea to Constantinople to the Mediterranean ports to popular pilgrimage sites in southern Europe and then eventually north. The fact that outbreaks consistently follow trade and pilgrimage routes hurts the anthrax hypothesis, which is based on infections occurring in livestock populations. While there seems to be some evidence of infected livestock in places like England, Wales, and Scotland, there's considerably less evidence of this type of infection in animals on the European continent. So the anthrax hypothesis only really works well for the British Isles. So, while the anthrax theory is certainly better supported than the plague from space, it raises almost as many questions as it answers. The alternate explanation that I find most compelling is one developed by demographer Susan Scott and zoologist Christopher Duncan, both from Liverpool University. Their hypothesis is that the Black Death wasn't caused by Yersinia pestis, anthrax, or any other bacteria. Instead, they posit that the Black Death was actually caused by a virus. The virus would have been a hemorrhagic fever, somewhat similar to Ebola. Like Ebola, the virus would have been able to spread from person to person relatively easily through saliva, sweat, and other bodily fluids. They point out that epidemics of hemorrhagic fever actually have a long history in Africa, the Middle East, and Europe. For instance, victims of the famous Plague of Athens that struck during the Peloponnesian War in 429 BC seem to exhibit symptoms consistent with a viral hemorrhagic fever. These include flu-like symptoms, but also small red or purple spots on the skin, bleeding, the vomiting of blood, and swelling. Most notably for us, viral hemorrhagic fevers can also cause the swelling of the glands, which would look quite a lot like buboes. It's the contention of Scott and Duncan that the symptoms described during the Black Death could just have easily been caused by a hemorrhagic fever as Yersinia pestis. A viral hemorrhagic fever also would have been far more consistent with the levels of contagion described by the medieval sources. As we know from modern outbreaks of Ebola, these types of diseases are incredibly contagious. Perhaps the most convincing piece of evidence used by Scott and Duncan has to do with the long incubation period usually seen in hemorrhagic fevers. It turns out that most people infected with a hemorrhagic fever do not show symptoms of the disease for up to 32 days after infection. However, the person is still quite contagious during that incubation period. This is quite different from Yersinia pestis. In cases of Yersinia pestis, you are showing symptoms very quickly after infection, and you're usually dead from the disease within a matter of days. The long incubation period associated with these hemorrhagic fevers helps explain how the disease was able to travel so far so quickly. People who assumed themselves to be healthy were actually infected. As they moved, the disease moved with them. To support this argument, Scott and Duncan point to a description written by Daniel Defoe during the so-called Great Plague in London in 1665. Defoe wrote this of the disease, quote, "Because of its infectious nature, the disease may be spread by apparently healthy people who harbor the disease but have not yet exhibited the symptoms. Such a person was in fact a poisoner, a walking destroyer, perhaps for a week or a fortnight before his death, who might have ruined those that he would have hazarded his life to save, breathing death upon him, even perhaps his tender kissing and embracing of his own children." End quote. So, at least during the 1665 plague, it was well known that a person could present as healthy for quite some time while inadvertently spreading the disease. Duncan and Scott also point out that medieval people seemed to have discovered that the only way to contain the disease was to impose a 40-day quarantine on anyone they assumed to be infected. They point to primary sources from across Europe that show that the so-called pest houses, or pestilence houses, that were used for quarantines, all eventually settled on a 40-day quarantine program to ensure that a potential plague carrier was free from the disease. Apparently, 40 days was settled on after 30-day quarantines were discovered to be ineffective. Once again, this is consistent with a viral hemorrhagic fever and not Yersinia pestis. If the disease was a virus and not a bacteria, it would also explain how it continued to claim lives during hot summers and cold winters that should have killed Yersinia pestis. It also explains how the plague was deadly even in places that had virtually no black rats. Finally, Scott and Duncan bring up the very interesting fact that a small percentage of modern people who are descended from Europeans, roughly 10%, have a genetic mutation that makes them immune to HIV. This mutation seems to have started back in 1000 BC, but subsequent epidemics of hemorrhagic plague seem to have forced up its frequency in the European population. In other words, people with this very specific genetic mutation were able to survive hemorrhagic fevers. Therefore, they were able to pass on their genetics. So, the mutation became more common. Scott and Duncan propose that this mutation may have helped people survive the Black Death, because, if they're correct, it was just another viral hemorrhagic fever. Those survivors then passed on their DNA, which made that mutation far more common in the European population. So, according to Scott and Duncan, if you are of European descent and you have this particular genetic mutation, not only are you protected from HIV, which is, you know, pretty crazy in itself, but you also probably have a very distant ancestor who survived the Black Death. Now, I really like the theory put forward by Scott and Duncan. I think you can probably hear it in my voice. I always get excited about the ones I like. It very neatly solves many of the problems created by the Yersinia pestis hypothesis. It also made me completely reevaluate my thoughts on the Siege of Kaffa. If the plague corpses launched by the Mongol Khan into Kaffa had actually been infected with a hemorrhagic fever, then the survivors of Kaffa may have, in fact, brought that disease to Europe, given its 32-day incubation period. That's certainly long enough to make the sale while still appearing healthy. So, you know, maybe I've got to go back and reevaluate episode one. Now, I was ready to leave it there, but it should be noted that Scott and Duncan's hypothesis still hasn't been widely embraced by both historians and the scientific community. They make a very reasonable case, but their case rests on the existence of a long since disappeared virus. If this hemorrhagic fever once existed, it doesn't exist anymore. When you can't find the virus, it's kind of like having a missing murder weapon. It doesn't mean they're wrong, it just means a key piece of evidence isn't there. So now that I've gone to all the trouble of talking you out of thinking that Yersinia pestis caused the Black Death, now I'm going to have to bring you back to the mainstream theory. Because here's the thing. Relatively recent scientific findings have actually helped support the traditional understanding of the Black Death. A number of studies have been undertaken on mass graves or plague pits associated with the 14th century Black Death. In many of these plague pits, not all, but many, the DNA signature and the protein signatures of our old friend Yersinia pestis have been found in the teeth of the dead. Yersinia pestis was certainly in the mix when these people died. Its signature is all over their bones. The most conclusive study of this was conducted in 2010. After finding Yersinia pestis in a variety of plague pits across Europe, the authors concluded that this, quote, ends the debate about the etiology of the Black Death and unambiguously demonstrates that Yersinia pestis was the causative agent of the epidemic plague that devastated Europe during the Middle Ages, end quote. Whew, that's pretty straightforward right there. That study also discovered that Yersinia pestis bacteria in those pits was actually quite different from the modern form of the bacteria. This is to be expected considering how quickly bacteria populations mutate and evolve. As such, it's reasonable to conclude that the medieval strain of the bacteria was simply more deadly and possibly more contagious than the modern strain. It would have been advantageous for the bacteria to become less deadly over time because in its more deadly medieval incarnation, it very nearly wiped out all of its hosts. When you're a bacteria, you need hosts, so you better not kill them all. The medieval brand of the bacteria was simply meaner, tougher, more contagious, and more likely to kill you back then. And the ancient bacterial DNA that's been found seems to prove it. How was the plague able to spread so fast and last in places that today's modern plague could not last? Well, it was just a different bacteria back then. The modern plague is less intense than the medieval plague because modern bacteria is less intense than the medieval bacteria. But there's always a chance that multiple diseases were at play. Now, we're getting into my own personal pet theory here, so bear with me. Based on the most recent research, it seems very clear that Yersinia pestis was in the mix during the Black Death. I mean, they found it in the plague pits, so it's kind of hard to deny. But what if there was both bubonic plague spread by Yersinia pestis and a hemorrhagic fever like the one described by Scott and Duncan? And what if anthrax was in the mix in some parts of Europe as well, like England and Scotland? What if the Black Death was a perfect storm of disease? What if an overcrowded continent got hit with a 1-2 punch of a killer bacteria and a killer virus? That would be a recipe for an unprecedented amount of death. And if there's one thing that we know for sure about the great mortality, it's that there was an unprecedented amount of death. But of course, now I'm indulging in speculation. And if I've learned anything from this examination of the Black Death, it's that speculation can sometimes be a dangerous thing. When trying to get to the bottom of a deadly and mysterious disease, there's nothing wrong with asking questions. We just need to make sure we don't let our prejudices or our preconceived notions about who is sick and who is healthy cloud our judgment. If we let fear and paranoia govern our understanding of disease, it can lead us in some very dark directions. Before you know it, we're inventing tales of basilisk poisons and turning on our neighbors. So remember, be nice. Okay, that's all for this week. Join us again in 2 weeks' time when we will explore another historical myth. Before we go this week, I would like to give a shout out to the following people. Big ups to Michael J. Owensby, to Jean Boyvin, to Julie Laudering, to Autumn Skelly, to Crystal Gregory, to Mike Kennedy, to Philip Surkov, to Meet Surter, to Christopher Cheney, to James Gianfrancesco, to Valentin Elizalde, and to Greg Helfrich. All of you people have decided to pledge at $5 or more every month. Some of you on that list are pledging at more than $5. And so, hey, you know what that means? You are all beautiful human beings. Thank you so much for your support of this show. Thank you to everyone who continues to support on Patreon. Thanks to everyone that goes out and buys extra episodes. Thanks to everyone that goes to tpublic.com and buys t-shirts and other merch. Thanks to everyone that writes nice reviews of the show and spreads the word about our fake history. All of you have made this show a success, so thank you. And you've made my life considerably better because of this. So, I mean, I can't thank you enough. I know I do it every episode, but I really, truly mean it. So just thanks again. Thanks for being awesome. If you want to get in touch with me, you can always send me an email at ourfakehistory@gmail.com. You can hit me up on Facebook at facebook.com/ourfakehistory, where you can follow along with everything I post there. Or you can always reach out to me on Twitter. I'm at ourfakehistory on Twitter, and I love having a little back and forth on the Twitter. So find me there. As always, the theme music for the show comes to us from Dirty Church. You can check out Dirty Church at dirtychurch.bandcamp.com. And all the other music that you heard on the show today was written and recorded by me. My name is Sebastian Major, and remember, just because it didn't happen doesn't mean it isn't real.